Okay, pull out your pocket constitutions and answer this question. Do you have a constitutional right to smile? Go ahead, look. Article 1, Article 2, Bill of Rights. You can look as long as you want, and you're not going to find any reference to smiling. You will, however, see a couple of references to liberty, and so the answer to this silly question is actually yes. If the government tried to regulate your right to smile, the government would be trampling on some kind of constitutional interest. Today, we're going to speak with a young lady who grew up in a country where she wasn't allowed to smile. In fact, she wasn't allowed to do lots of things there, and we're going to contrast her experience there with her experience here. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's from Romania with love.
Your Weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
I really enjoy getting to know my students, and some of them have just remarkable stories. They're from all sorts of different backgrounds, but I must say that one of the most unusual and the most inspiring is a young lady I met named Irina Dan. She's now married. It's Irina Dan McGarry. And I was so impressed by her story that when I was asked to do a television commercial for the Appalachian School of Law, I could think of no one better than Irina. So let's let her introduce herself.
I'm Irina McGarry. I was born into a communist dictatorship in Romania, but then I moved to America, where I proudly served in the United States Army. Now, I am a law student at the Appalachian School of Law, where I studied the Constitution of the United States. ASL welcomes veterans with open arms and open hearts.
ASL is a proud participant in the Yellow Ribbon Program for veterans. Visit us at asl.edu.
Did that bring a tear to your eye? It was supposed to. I was just so impressed with Irina's story that I thought you'd enjoy hearing a fuller version of it. That's why we've entitled today's episode From Romania with Love, because as you're going to hear, it's a lot about Romania and what happened to Irina as a little girl there, but it's all also about what happened to her after she got out, after she made her way to the United States, and even a little bit about meeting her sweetie pie over at the law school. So without further ado, here's Irina. Well, actually, no. Let me back up and give a little bit of context. Just for the geographically challenged, Romania is a country in southeastern Europe. It's at the northern tip of an area that we call the Balkans. It has a coast along the Black Sea. It's actually quite close to an area that you've probably been following in the news. Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula is not very far from there. It's an area that has long suffered under various dictatorships. It was allied with the Nazis during World War II. It then changed dictatorships when the Soviets rolled through and installed their own government. They installed one fellow. He lasted about 20 years into the 1960s. He was succeeded by a fellow named Nicolae Ceaușescu. He lasted another 25 years or so, and that's really where Irina's story begins, because she was born in the early 1980s, and she lived through the last few years of the Ceaușescu dictatorship. Now, what's interesting about her is that, you know, while all Romanians were oppressed, she suffered a particular disability because her grandfather, one of her grandfathers, had dared to leave the country against the wishes of the communist dictatorship in the 1960s. And when you are the child or the grandchild of a supposed traitor, well, then you have special difficulties that you have to overcome. So that's more or less where we pick up. I ask Irina to tell me about her childhood in the early 1980s, growing up under Nicolae Ceaușescu's dictatorship. And here's what she has to say.
Being in the United States made me realize what I didn't have there, because I didn't realize it as a child. For me, growing up in school, I used to get beat by my teachers.
You were beaten by your
teachers? Yes, very much. And
now, when you say beaten, could you be a little more specific?
Absolutely.
I mean, what do you mean by beaten? With fists on your face?
Yes, they would take... When you took a test, it's not like the United States test, when you have a piece of paper and a pen and you take your test. In Romania, they used to, let's say it was a math test, so you would be in front of your whole class and they would ask you to come to the blackboard. The blackboard was about the size of a wall, and the teacher would give you a problem to do in front of the whole class, and that was your exam. And God forbid you got the wrong answer. They like to take you by the hair and basically slam your head against the blackboard. And it was all the time. It would happen all the time. It happened to me all the time. I was more fortunate because my parents were able to get cigarettes and alcohol and coffee from the black market. My parents were very well known in Romania, so I wasn't beat because I would bribe the teacher. And the parents that could do that, then their children would not be beat in school. So I would go and, you know, bring the teacher every day a pack of cigarettes or coffee for her not to beat me. I remember a young guy that was with me in class, and I will always remember him. His name was Vlad, and he came from a very, very poor family. Dad was not around. Mom was an alcoholic, and everybody knew this, and it was very shameful to have anybody as an alcoholic, or it was shameful. It wasn't something that you could get help for. It's very shameful, and he would get beat every day. The teacher would just walk by us and just slap him. For no reason. He didn't do anything. They'd just slap him. We would have to sit with our hands behind our backs. If you didn't have anything to do, if you didn't have anything to say, then your hands better be behind your back. Interlock your hands and just hold them behind your back. And we had uniforms, obviously, and it was the communist youth uniforms, and they better be very, very, very well-shaped. You're not allowed to be a child, basically. Children get dirty. Mm-hmm. No, not us. And as far as smiling is concerned, I have pictures, and none of them. I don't smile in any of them, and it's because I was told not to. You can't smile.
Really? They didn't want smiling children.
They wanted serious pictures. They wanted to make it like serious portraits. I don't really know what they were thinking, but we weren't allowed to smile. There was no such thing as recess. When you have recess in school here, I see children going to the playground and playing and things like that. No, we were taken to a gym and we had to do gymnastics, or we had to do whatever the Communist Party wanted us to do. There was no such thing as fun, per se. No fun. And it was hard because, you know, children here grow up with even having the opportunity to get chocolate or oranges or bananas. We didn't. Those were things that once in a year, maybe.
Well, obviously, you didn't know anything else.
You were
a little girl growing up in this environment, so it's kind of hard to remember how you felt back then. But how did you feel as a little girl in this environment? Did you realize what deprivation you were enduring, or what sort of society you were living in?
Not at all. It was perfectly normal to me. Perfectly normal.
Okay, so you've told us how it was when you were a little girl there. Tell us a little bit more about this fellow Ceausescu. What sort of stuff was he up to when you were there?
He had a lot of control over the press. Mm-hmm. The press was he controlled all the information that came and went from Romania. The only thing that was allowed from the outside was the bad news. So if United States was up to no good, if there was massive killings or something, then that mm-hmm. was on the news in Romania. Only the bad news. Mm-hmm. He controlled everything. The newspapers were controlled. The reporters actually had to give a handwriting sample. In order for you to be a reporter during that time, you had to give a handwriting sample. So they had your handwriting sample. So God forbid you write something that you're not supposed to, then they can match it and who knows what will happen then.
Wow.
So he censored absolutely everything that went on TV. TV was only allowed for 2 hours. That's it. Mm-hmm. During the day. And the only thing that was on was how wonderful Ceausescu was and how happy people were to be part of communism and how everybody was happy and the food was great. And
you know, I think you've told me in the past about this. Didn't they have these rallies around the country, and weren't people co-opted into participating in them?
Yes. He was very big on shows, mm-hmm. huge on shows. He wanted shows that would be dedicated to him and his wife. The shows were absurd. They were very big. It's a massive production. People were taken out of their homes 2 months in advance to rehearse for these shows. They would rehearse 16 hours a day with only two 10-minute breaks. And I'm talking about the farmers, the engineers, the whatever. It doesn't matter what you did. You would be taken out of your home, and you had to perform in those shows.
When you say shows, what do you mean a show?
Shows, meaning think about how the Super Bowl or the beginning of a Olympic Games type of production.
These are spectacles.
Yes.
This sounds like one of these rallies in North Korea where everybody's
yes.
synchronized.
This,
yes. They were pulling that stuff.
Absolutely, yes. And thousands of people, you had to participate in those shows. And if you didn't participate in those shows, you had to be a spectator. So every single seat was taken in those big, huge, massive stadiums. You had to. They would take you out of your home, and you would have to be there. And the thing that affects me to this day is at the end of the shows, the actors would turn into the spectators because everybody would turn toward Ceausescu and his wife and start applauding them. Like, they just put on this show, and, like, they just performed and did all this work for the past 2 months because they wanted to be praised. They wanted to show everybody how wonderful being a communist was.
And this is what the sort of thing they'd put on the television.
Yes.
I'm trying to look at it from Ceausescu's perspective, so he would just basically say, I want a big rally for me and my wife in this city. So you all start planning. And
yes.
for the next 18 months, you're going to put this together. And then I'm going to show up in my helicopter, I guess.
Yes.
And I'm going to show up, and you're all going to praise me and clap for me, and I'm going to put it on television.
Yes. He went further. He actually, if he was to go through a town, so let's say the president would come to this town right now, they would take the children out of schools, and they would line them up against the sidewalks. And they would keep them there for hours on end. You're not allowed to go to the bathroom. You're not allowed to have food. It didn't matter if it rained, snowed, hailed. Does not matter. You would sit there, and you would chant, and you would be happy because the president is coming. And when he comes, you're going to cheer, and you're going to be happy for hours. And
do you recall participating in any of these things as a little girl?
I recall participating in a lot of things at school, plays that we had to do, and we also had to, the children here in the United States, they do the pledge.
Sure.
And in Romania, we had to do similar type of pledge, but to Ceausescu. And it was a type of pledge that we had to say how wonderful everything is. And it was because of him, the sun would shine during the day. And it was because of him, we had bread on the table. Everything was because of the Ceausescu. Everything was because he allowed us to be communists.
Well, we pledge allegiance to our flag and for the republic for which it stands, okay? And moreover, children are not required to do this. If children
Correct.
Decide they don't wish to do it or it defies their beliefs, they don't have to do it. But you were pledging to one person.
Yes, I was. And
you were pledging, and if you didn't pledge, what would happen to you?
I would get beat. Who knows what would happen to my parents? My parents could have gotten arrested, put in jail, killed. You had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It was not, you had to memorize it. And I remember actually stories of children not wanting to say it and parents saying, think about this. Mothers actually telling their sons, think about this. When you say this, think about me. Think about that you're saying this to me.
Hmm.
Because, you know, children didn't want to memorize something like this. Or
how frightening it would be for a parent to think about his or her child being beaten, but then also to think about his or her child just doing something that a kid might do.
Yes.
You know, kids don't always do what their parents want them to do, and all of a sudden the secret police show up at your house.
Yes.
Because your kid decided he was going to misbehave that day.
Yes. The whole system, Ceausescu had a whole system of lies. Everything in the media was lies. One of the main things Ceausescu wanted to do is pay the outside debt. The country was in debt to foreign countries.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to pay the outside debt. So what would happen is, let's say you are a pig farmer, okay? So he would mandate you specifically and say, I need you to raise 100 pigs, okay? And, of course, you don't want to die or your family to die. So at the end of the year or something like that, he would come to you and say, okay, do you have 100 pigs? And, of course, you're going to say, yes, I have 100 pigs. And technically, you probably had 50 pigs. So what he would say to you is, okay, 50 goes to the export, goes to pay off our debt and so on, and 50 stay in the country to feed our people, right? But you only had 50, so you would take it to do the debt for the outside, and then the 50 that was supposed to be coming to the country and the people, there was none. So the food, there was no food. But the media.
That's an important point. Let me interrupt you there briefly, because I think perhaps especially some of our younger listeners might not realize that there's a common theme going through a lot of what you say. You say there's no food. There's the economy's in bad shape. The country's in debt. We're having to send all these things overseas. People don't realize that one of the basic problems with a communist system is that it doesn't work.
It
sounds wonderful in theory. And in fact, if you read Karl Marx or if you read some Lenin, all about sharing and from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, a lot of it sounds like the Christian gospel. It doesn't work. And therefore, chronically in these Eastern European countries, including the Soviet Union, you had failed harvests.
Yes.
You had economies that weren't producing enough for the people to eat. You had all sorts of problems, and this led to scarcities, which these countries tried to simply dismiss or to deny or to mandate out of existence. You will produce 50 pigs or 100 pigs, and that it doesn't work that way. The economy doesn't function that way. And when it didn't work, that's when the political repression became necessary, because people are starving. People can't do what they're being commanded to do or won't do what they're being commanded to do, and therefore little kids don't have enough to eat.
No, they didn't. And there is a story that my father told me just last week. We were talking about food and in Romania, and one of his friends actually tried to go and buy a refrigerator.
That must have been a luxury
item. The police stopped him.
They stopped him.
And said, "What do you need a refrigerator for? You have nothing to put in anyways. Why do you need it?" So started questioning him on why he wants a refrigerator. Obviously, he didn't get a refrigerator, but those were the times. Everything was rationed. Everything. Oil, sugar, anything was rationed. If you didn't have connections, black market, there was the black market. And you could get chickens and pigs and things like that from the black market. So if you were in the Communist Party, like my parents were both in the Communist Party because they had to be. And they had high positions, so...
No, wait a second. I have to ask about that.
Yes.
Granddad was a traitor.
Yes.
And again, he was dad's dad or mom's dad?
Mom's dad.
Okay, so mom's dad is a traitor.
Yes.
So you guys are under scrutiny.
Very much.
But you just told me they had high positions in the Communist Party. Now,
right.
What was that?
Okay.
How did that happen?
When the Communist Party came in and said, okay, you have to prove your allegiance to us, and in order for you to have a house or an apartment or anything, you had to be part of the Communist Party, or even a job. The communists said, okay, everybody has a job, everybody has a house. Not true. If you were part of the Communist Party, you had a job and a house. My mother and my father were very well known and high up because they joined, and it was basically an example of she turned her back on her father, and she did this, and he did this, and it was
She was trying to prove how loyal she was because of her father's supposed treachery.
Yes.
And apparently she and your dad were very good at this.
Yes, they were very good at it, and they had to carry their little red type of book with them and the whole nine yards, and they had to believe. I asked my father, I asked him, did you believe in it? No. He told me, I don't believe in anything the communists say, but you had to agree with them.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're speaking with a young lady, one of my law students. Her name is Irina Dan McGarry, and as you've heard, she grew up in communist Romania and had a pretty rough time of it. She was telling us about her parents' attempts to escape and her own experiences there, and we're going to pick up with the rest of her story after the break. But the reason we're doing this, if it hasn't already occurred to you, is that this is quite a contrast, isn't it, with the constitutional protections that we enjoy here. And I think it's very important for us as Americans to remind ourselves just how fortunate we are from time to time. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and hear some more of Irina's story. Stick around.
Well, once again, it's that special time in the show when Doug Smith from the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution just comes walking with a jaunty step into the studio. And he is, in fact, the quiz guy, and I see he has a really lengthy and difficult-looking quiz with him today. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. You have sort of a grin on your face today. Is this a particularly tough one?
No, it's not that it's particularly tough. It's just it's always a pleasure to see you.
It's always a pleasure to see you, too. I just get a warm fuzzy every single time. Speaking of which, I get a warm fuzzy when we get someone on the telephone line. Do we have anybody today? We have a contestant?
Yes, we do.
Tremendous. And who is this?
This is Dan from Fort Myers, Florida.
Dan from Fort Myers, Florida. How is the weather in Fort Myers?
Well, currently it's raining, but the last couple of days it's been pretty sunny out in the 70s and 80s, so not bad for a spring break, honestly.
Not bad at all for spring break time in Florida with all of the people with their oiled up bodies and bikinis. Okay, I'm just going to stop. I'm not the only one to think about it now. Okay, Dan. Before we let you get back to the sun and the surf, I am going to ask Doug to go ahead and ask the quiz question.
All right, Stuart. Well, here's the question for today. How many states were required to ratify the U.S. Constitution? Was it A, 6 states, B, 9 states, C, 12 colonies, or D, 14? Colonies.
Okay, now before I turn this over to Daniel, I want to make sure I understand the question. You say, how many states were required to ratify the Constitution? And by that, you mean before it would go into effect?
Before, yeah, you know, we all know that in 1787, met in Philadelphia, signers.
Yeah. But I guess what you're saying is that from those answer choices, it didn't have to be all of them. I mean, there were 13 states, right? But I didn't. None of those answer choices said 13.
Are you the contestant?
I'm just clarifying that it was something less than everybody. So that's interesting.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting you should ask that because keep in mind, I mean, is there a legislature or a legislative body in the country that thinks they're going to get 100% agreement?
Oh, a very important point. Okay, well, we've given you enough hints, Dan. Do you have any idea how many, something less than 13, how many of these original 13 states had to ratify this new constitution that went out there to the states in 1787 before it would actually take effect?
I think I'm going to go with B, 9 states, because not all of them wanted to ratify it.
Okay, well, you think it's B, 9?
Anyway.
You think it's 9 states? But out of all these choices, why 9? Why not 6?
6 is less than half.
Oh, so 6 is less than half. That's a point.
I do remember, I don't know if it was Delaware. One of the states did not want to ratify it.
Delaware was actually the first to ratify.
Majority of them. Maybe it was New York. But I'm going to go with B9.
He's going to go with B9. I don't seem to be able to talk him out of it, so I'm going to look at Doug. Doug, is that the correct answer?
I really thought he was going to say 14 colonies. But he's correct. It was 9 states that had to ratify in order for it to really go into effect.
Wow. And so who was the 9th state, or which was the 9th state?
Well, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Yeah,
was.
But you're correct. The first state indeed was Delaware.
Right.
December 7th, a day that'll live in infamy in many, many ways.
Uh-huh.
1787, just a few months after the convention, they were the first to kick it off. And then there was a lot of debates at the state level, in the state houses, about what this constitution was, particularly if the people who were at the convention, the delegates of the convention, overstepped their authority a bit.
Oh, yeah.
And it took a while. It took a while for all this, about 10 months for the states to ratify this.
Took the better part of a year, and sometimes people think that Virginia was the last to ratify, or New York, because those were the two biggest and most important states. But strangely enough, they both ratified after New Hampshire had, and so they, in a way, their inclusion was sort of a bonus, a big bonus. But technically, things had already, at least constitutionally speaking, moved forward. So, Dan, congratulations. You got the correct answer.
All right.
You're going to get a T-shirt.
All right. It's the highlight of my spring break so far.
Well, I don't know what that says about your spring break, but I'm going to leave it at that. You go ahead and please email us at ywc@montpelier.org and give Carol, our scheduler, your T-shirt size, and we will have one waiting for you.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. And thank you, Doug.
Absolutely. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the article.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Today I'm speaking with one of my law students. Her name is Irina Dan. Actually, it's Irina Dan McGarry. She's married now. And she's telling me her remarkable story of growing up in a communist dictatorship, specifically in the country of Romania, under a fellow by the name of Ceausescu. You may have heard of him. And the difficulties that she encountered as a little girl and the difficulty her parents encountered and the separation that they endured for a number of years. We left off when she was telling us about how her parents, who were actually considered traitors or the children of traitors, actually joined the Communist Party and did it out of defense. They had to do it to prove just how loyal they were.
The way it worked is the housing there, you had to be part of the Communist Party to get housing. You had to be part of the Communist Party to get food, to do anything like that. And they had to do what they had to do to survive. And they joined. And the way the work was, everybody worked 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. My parents told me they couldn't even believe that here there's 2 days off. No, nobody... They couldn't understand that.
Wow.
They could not understand that. So, but the Communist Party, as far as having jobs, you had a job and you had money coming from that job, but there was nothing that you can use your money on. You couldn't go on vacations because you weren't allowed to leave the country or anything. You could go on vacations in the country, but not outside the country. And as far as food, there was the shelves, supermarket shelves were empty. Empty. And if you wanted to get milk or anything like that, you would have to stay in line for hours and hours on end. And everything was rationed. And it would usually be overnight that you would have to stay in lines to get milk or to get bread and so on. And nothing was available. People were starving, yet the newspapers kept on saying how people were happy and how everybody was wonderful in this country.
I keep mentioning George Orwell's famous book, 1984, but I mean, the parallels are just so strong.
Yes.
Everybody's happy as they stand around thin, gaunt, and starving.
Yes. Ceausescu was way gone. He was not in touch with reality as far as what the people were going through. He wasn't in touch with reality. I remember a harvest festival. He demanded to have a harvest festival.
A harvest festival.
Yes.
Okay.
Meaning you have to have harvest to have a harvest festival, right? And your harvest cannot be dead.
One would think, yeah.
Well, he said to this one of the little towns that, hey, I'm coming and I am going. I want to see your harvest. And, of course, the people of that kind of the little town said, okay, well, he's coming. He's coming with his helicopter and we better have something going on. And what they did is they started painting the fields green and showing how beautiful it looks. And they started painting rocks and wood and making it look like food. So when he showed up...
Wait. They're painting rocks...
Yes.
...to make it look like food.
Yes.
They're painting the fields green...
Yes.
...just for Ceausescu and his television cameras.
Yes. He is coming, so you better figure it out. And they painted cheeses and breads and fruits and everything. Huge display, harvest display, right? And he came, he landed, he looked, took pictures and left. Thank God that he didn't go and try to get a piece of cheese or a piece of anything because they were fake. Everything was fake. It went even further than this. What he demanded, he had. In the city that I was born in is Mejidia. Mejidia has a canal running through it. And the canal is a straight type of passage to the Black Sea. He demanded the people to build this canal. Okay, and like I said, the city I was born in goes through the city, the canal.
Mm-hmm.
So the city has this huge canal in the middle of it, and it connects it to the Black Sea. It makes it like a passage, like a shortcut to the Black Sea. Well, he said, okay, the canal better be ready by this time. That's it. Of course, the canal wasn't ready by a certain time. There was no... They didn't have anything to build it with. They had all kinds of issues with the building of this canal. But what happened was he told the people, well, I'm coming. I want to see the progress. So what did the people do? Filled this part of the canal that was done with water everything around it they painted. They painted dead cypress trees. They were dead, but they painted them green. So everything looks pretty. Everything is great. The canal is ready. And when he flew by, he saw that the canal was ready.
Good heavens. Now, you have to wonder, did this guy realize what was going on, or was he truly in la-la land?
I can't understand how far away from reality you have to be to not realize something like this. But that's what was going on all the time.
Now, you've mentioned his wife a couple of times. Tell me about her.
She treated people like rats. She referred to people as rats that should be executed on sight, which she did. She felt like everybody should call her Commander Elena Ceaușescu, great scientist of international esteem.
Was she a scientist?
Absolutely not. She was when she dropped out of school, she was 14 years old, had no former education. She could barely read and write. People would write books, and she would write her name to it, pretend that that's her book. Those are her, and she would be photographed in lab coats, like a doctor would be, and she was wonderful. She was educated, and nobody was educated as she was. That is the way she conducted herself, and she was a very jealous person too. She wasn't the best looking woman, mm-hmm. and she was very jealous, and she was very cunning as far as she would kill people. She would execute. I don't care. Doesn't matter. I consider you a rat, and that's what you are, and that's the way she treated people while they were living in palaces. And because that's what they did, where if you ever go to Romania, the capital is absolutely beautiful. The Romanian people have one of the biggest buildings for their parliament. It's like a castle. It's huge and it's absolutely beautiful. But that is what Ceaușescu wanted everybody to see about the country, how rich the country was and how wonderful the country was. The architecture in Romania, in Bucharest, is amazing. It's absolutely beautiful. But that's all he concentrated on. And while the rest of the country is an agriculture country, where everybody's starving, he literally, in the capital, both of them were very against God. They were, no mm-hmm. God. We don't want God. So what he ordered in the capital to have done, to move the churches. He literally moved churches. He picked up a church, literally, and moved it a few feet or whatever the case may be in more residential areas and cover them with trees around them so nobody sees the churches. And there's a lot of accounts of priests saying that it was like an apocalyptic event seeing this. But both of them were very, very much involved in what happened in Romania, both of them. It wasn't just Ceaușescu, it was Elena. It's just as much as Elena as it was Ceaușescu.
And they, you mentioned they kept very strict control on the press, and I guess that became more and more important in the years after you were born. So
yes.
You were born in 84.
Yes.
And great things were happening in the 1980s. We didn't, here in the West, we didn't recognize it, but roughly that time, a fellow by the name of Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the
yes.
Soviet Union after a series of old fellows.
Yes.
The old guard was trying to hang on in the early 1980s, but every time they picked a new chairman of the Communist Party, he would die a few months later. In the mid-80s, this relatively young fellow named Gorbachev, he was in his 50s at the time, came to power, and he adopted policies of reform. One was called glasnost, and that meant openness. Mm-hmm. One was called perestroika, and that meant restructuring. And he was trying to address these long-standing problems that all communist countries had, you know, the economic inefficiencies and difficulties and the repression that was associated with it. But, of course, that was something that was not necessarily welcomed in all of these client states and all of the Eastern powers. So I imagine, and you can tell me, Ceaușescu was trying to keep that from the people, all the things that were going on.
Very much. The Romanian people had no idea what was going on with the liberalization that Gorbachev was doing. Nothing. The Romanian people had no idea. 2 hours per day television, and it was all about Ceaușescu. And it was all about his achievements and exactly how the news was. My mother, when talking to her about this, about the press in general, she called it a joke. She said it was a joke. Press, 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 what press? Press was a joke.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're contrasting our experience living in a constitutional democracy with the experience of a young lady named Irina, who grew up in the communist dictatorship of Romania. It's quite a chilling tale, isn't it? After the break, we'll talk a few minutes with one of our buddies, Christian Coates from Montpelier, who's going to tell us about some really interesting tours that are starting up here just around the corner. And then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Irina. Stick around. Well, Christian Coates, welcome back to your Weekly Constitutional.
Thanks, Stuart. Great to be here.
Always good to have you now. Say, what's going on in your department these days?
Well, we're very busy these days. We're instituting some new tours for the spring season.
Really? What are these new tours?
Well, of course, we're going to still offer our standard tour, what we call the signature tour, which is offered every day on the hour.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also going to be offering some new in-depth experiences. And these are going to last between 90 minutes and 2 hours. And they focus on very specific subject matter. So we're going to be doing one tour on Madison and the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
one tour on Madison and slavery.
Oh, that's
and
important.
One tour, which I'm very excited about the women of Montpelier.
Mm-hmm. And not just Dolly, but other women
not
as
just
well.
Dolly, right. Right. Yeah, Montpelier has this great history of very interesting and strong female roles at Montpelier. So starting with James Madison's grandmother, Frances Madison, who mm-hmm. sort of ran the plantation after her husband's murder.
Yes.
And then his own mother, Nellie Madison, and then Dolly, and then Marion Dupont Scott, who, mm-hmm. you know, ran the place for the better part of the 20th century. But we're also going to be focusing on some of the enslaved women who made the plantation work. So slaves like Suki and Katie, who were Dolly's lady's maid and perhaps her cook.
Do we know much about those enslaved women?
I mean, we don't,
beyond their names.
Yeah, we don't know a whole lot, but we do have some documentary evidence from letters from Dolly and actually letters between some of the slaves. Katie, for instance, is very interesting because she winds up with Dolly at the end of Dolly's life in Washington,
mm-hmm.
And then actually sues Payne Todd for her freedom.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's some really interesting stories.
Well, that sounds like it. And this sounds like a really great idea, Christian, because, of course, most people listening might be inclined toward that first tour by definition, someone who's listening to the show is interested in the Constitution. But having specific tours devoted to slavery or specific tours devoted to prominent women at Montpelier might be different points of access for people.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, in the past, we've offered our normal, you know, hour-long house tour, which is sort of a broad brush. You know, mm-hmm. we talk about a lot of different topics, but we don't really have the time to get into any of them in particular. And these three subjects are the topics that most people want to know more about.
Oh, okay.
So
that's
we thought,
cool.
Why not offer more in-depth experiences and take a little bit longer? You're still moving through the house. You're still moving through the grounds. You get to see the mansion. You get that Montpelier experience. But you're focusing on these particular subjects, which are just more meaty and which take a little bit longer to talk about.
Well, I imagine a person visiting Montpelier might want to do more than one of these.
Absolutely.
Even on the same day, you could do a couple.
Absolutely.
Of them,
right? And that was one of the other rubs in the past, was that we only offered these more specially focused tours on weekends, mm-hmm. and only once during that weekend. And so now they'll be offered every day, twice a day.
Oh, that's very nice. Now, I'm guessing that you probably have to charge a little bit more for one of these in-depth tours.
Yeah, well, this year it's a special deal.
Oh, really?
before we, you know, to see how popular these are, the extended tours will only be an additional $2.
Wow.
So it's the normal ticket price is $18 for adults, $7 for kids. I'm not even sure. I don't believe we're going to charge any more for children.
Wow.
But adults will be $20 for the in-depth experience.
Well, that'd be great. Yeah, you could get in and out of here with a special tour. You get the general tour, the general experience, and then you get the special tour, and you'd still be out for about $20.
And if you really plan your day well, you could take all three.
That would be an
intense
experience.
And I'm sure we'll offer you a package price.
I'm sure. I think that might be a very good way to do it. I mean, even though you're seeing many of the same things, you're looking at them from two or three different perspectives.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
I've seen books written that way. I've seen movies done that way, where you see one scene from one character's perspective and then from another character's perspective, and it's nice to juxtapose them like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, and they'll also visit different venues too. Mm-hmm. So the like the women's tour will go to the DuPont Gallery to talk about Marion and the DuPont family role, and the slavery tour will go through the South Yard structures and out onto the terrace.
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution tour will have a segment in Nellie's bedroom wing, where there'll be more of a Q&A and sit-down experience.
Well, that sounds very cool. Now, have these already begun, these extra tours?
They have not. They are actually still being written. But
okay. And that's what you're up to.
Yeah, we are writing and training as we speak over at Montpelier.
So when will these be unveiled?
April 1st.
April 1st. So if you're interested in any of these special tours, start planning your trip now. And you can do a lot of that at montpelier.org, I'm guessing.
Absolutely.
And you, of course, are Christian Coates, and they can reach you as well with specific questions. And you're on the website, aren't you?
Yep, ccotz@montpelier.org.
Well, tremendous. Well, Christian Coates, thanks very much for coming in again.
Thanks, Stuart. Always a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my discussion with Irina, a young woman who grew up in communist Romania.
Born in 84, mm-hmm. So you were how old when your mom decided she was going to leave the country?
Okay, I was about 2 years old, something
wow.
like that, and then...
So your mom decided she's going to leave the country in about 86?
Yes.
And you were only 2 years old?
Yes.
Did you have brothers and sisters at the time?
No, not at the time.
You were the first
mm-hmm.
one, but that yep. must have been so hard for her
yep.
to say, I'm going to leave the country and leave behind my husband and my two-year-old daughter.
Yeah, it was... I'm sure it was a hard decision. I don't have children, but I'm sure that would be an impossible decision. But every day, I thank my parents for giving my sister and I the opportunity to be here.
Wait a second. We're getting ahead of ourselves. We don't know about the sister yet. So your mom leaves
yes.
in 86.
Yes.
What happened back. After that? She came back.
She came back.
Why would she come back?
She when she left, my dad and her went to the... They went to the embassy to get their visas and so on, and they said they were put in this room in a kind of like a hotel room, and they turned on the television very loudly because they knew the room was bugged. The mm-hmm. room had microphones all over it, and what they did is they had a newspaper. They wrote down on the newspaper a conversation between them, and the final word was, "Don't come back. No matter what, do not come back."
And this was your mother telling your... No, your...
My father telling my mother,
father telling
don't
your
come back no matter what, you're going, and that's it. You got to get out of here. And, of course, when everything happened...
So mom leaves the country.
Yes.
She comes to the United States.
Yes.
She's hanging out with her own father who's
yes.
left. Okay, so she and the quote-unquote traitor have been united in the United States. And then what happens next?
My mother...
She comes back, right?
She comes back.
What brought her back?
That she didn't want anything to happen to my father, my sister, and I. We could have been executed.
But what made her think she could get you out?
She didn't. She didn't think that. She knew that when she came back, this was it. We would live or die in Romania. That's it. They would not be.
Well, obviously something happened, though. This is all 1989. She's
yes.
coming back.
Yes.
Okay. So some pretty significant things happened in 89.
Yes.
So she comes back to Romania, and then...
My sister is born shortly after. She gets pregnant. My sister's born shortly after.
Right. So
and
mom
then,
and dad get back together, and
yes.
then sister results.
Yes.
Okay.
And then my father leaves. My father is... has an opportunity to leave to United States, and he comes to United States and
joins. He can leave, and that's what I was trying to get to, is that he can leave because in 89 the Berlin Wall falls.
Yes,
okay.
It was a little bit easier for them to leave. It was still very hard because when the Berlin Wall fell, the Securitate forces were still very much in power.
Down in Romania.
Yes, down in Romania. They were still very much in power, but shortly they were... coming down, but
mm-hmm.
still, it was very, very hard just to do it. And he left and joined.
So he managed to escape from
yes.
Romania in the chaos and the tumult surrounding
yes.
the fall of the Berlin Wall in mm-hmm. 1989. And then, what happens in Romania after the wall falls?
The Romanian people, there was a revolution. Right. The revolution was literally people getting their guns or whatever the case may be and fighting in the streets. They, Romanian people, had enough. They've had enough of the being controlled. And they were realizing this. Many Romanian people, probably to this day, unfortunately, thought that communism was better than what they have because they were provided certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But many of the Romanian people that wanted more from their lives was...
They did rebel. They rebelled in late 89.
Yes.
And what happened to Mr. and Mrs. Ceausescu?
They got executed on the steps of their home. And
wow, pretty public, wasn't it?
It was very public, and it was on TV 24 hours a day. It was the execution was live, and it was something that never happened in the Romanian history because, of course, the TV, you're only allowed 2 hours of TV.
That was a heck of a 2 hours.
Yes.
Excuse me.
So
I don't mean to make light of it. I mean, but that's how the Ceausescus ended up. I mean, they were dragged into the street and executed on live television.
Yes.
And revolutions are one thing, but what happened after that revolution? I mean, so after 1989, late 1989, what was the date again when Ceausescu got it?
December 25th. It was
so
Christmas.
Christmas Day.
Yeah.
So Christmas present to the Romanian people. What happens after that?
After that, the Romanian people are trying to basically overthrow the government, and that's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately...
Well, what replaced it, though?
Nothing good replaced it.
Oh, really?
The parties, there's a the parliament, obviously, and there's like a three-branch
mm-hmm.
government
mm-hmm.
in Romania. The sad part is everybody that was in the Securitate forces took power.
Mm.
And everybody that was in charge were still in charge. And unfortunately, this is still the case in Romania. Everybody that's in parliament right now, fortunately, they're the people, ex-communists and high leaders in the Communist Party. And actually, just now, I can honestly say that Romania is going towards taking corruption out of the government. So, yes, communism was gone, but this corrupt government came on. So
they got rid of Ceausescu and Mrs. Ceausescu, but they didn't really get rid of the system.
No, they did not.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's very corrupt. Romania to this day is a very corrupt country.
Before we get to that, but your family
gets
out roughly during this time. So let's get back to your family. What happened after the wall fell and after Ceausescu was dragged through the streets? How did you all get out?
My mother, my father came to the United States and... stayed here for a few years and without my sister and my mother and everybody, and told my mother, no, this is we have to stay here. You have to come to the United States. There's no way without. So my mother got out of the country again without my sister and I.
So mom and dad are both in the States and you're left in Romania.
Yeah,
with whom?
With my aunt.
And you're not even 10 years old at this point.
No. So my mother and father come to the United States, and my sister and I have no chance of coming to the United States because there are many rules to get, especially my sister and I, because, you know, in a few years, we could get married to an American citizen, you know, become citizens ourselves, and so on.
So the Romanian government didn't want you leaving because they...
There's no way.
You were what was keeping your parents under control, I guess.
Yes.
You were the anchors, okay?
Yes.
You were the hostages.
Then they were not going to allow my sister and I to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents tried for a long time to get my sister and I out. For many years, we lived with my aunt while my parents were sending us money. And that's the only reason why we were even able to make it in Romania. And
what sort of contact did you have with your parents? Did you get old-fashioned letters from them? Or what
I had a phone call once a week, a phone call. I remember it was Sundays usually, and we would get a phone call from them once a week. That's it, for about 10 minutes. They would send letters. The thing is about letters and packages, they would try to send packages because, of course, you know, they wanted to send dolls. My sister and I love dolls and Barbies mm-hmm. and so on, and they were none like that in Romania. But all those were being stolen. The system was so corrupt that any type of post office or anything, any package they came in, especially from the United States, they would be opened and the content be stolen.
Mm.
So any type of, they wouldn't send us cards or things like that just because there was no point. They would never get to us. Mm. So the contact that I had with my parents was once a week, a phone call. And that's about it for a few years.
How long did this go on?
About 5 years.
About 5 years. Yeah. So you're getting into your mid-teens now, and you've been living with your aunt.
Yes.
So what happened next?
After that, my parents, you know, all of us played the lottery sometimes and in hopes of winning. Well, my parents played the Visa lottery. This is a lottery that the United States government allows about 22,000 immigrants to come to this country. If they win this Visa lottery, they
from Romania.
No, from all over the world. It's an all over the world type of lottery, and the United States government gives a certain amount of visas for this lottery. The people that win the lottery, they get permanent residency in the United States with chances of becoming a citizen of the United States, and any children they have under 18 years old, then they get that as well, the same opportunity. I was under 18, my sister was under 18, and my mom won the Visa lottery.
Wow.
Yeah, the chances of winning the Visa lottery was, I mean, you know, I play the lottery, the money lottery, but, you know, we don't, I mean, the chances of winning it are just slim to none. But you play it in hopes you win it. Well, my mom won the Visa lottery.
And that must have been a banner day in your family.
The only reason why we are here today is because my mother won the Visa lottery.
And, well, how did you find out about that?
You know what? I remember our parents called, and I was just didn't really understand it, what was going on, because there were so many years of wanting to come to this country, wanting to see my parents, most of all. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got used to not seeing them, and I got used to basically raising my sister, because I took my sister under my wing a lot, even though we got treated amazing. My aunt is an amazing person, and her family is great. She treated us like our own children, but still, it wasn't my parents. So I became kind of like my sister's mother. When she saw me just a few weeks ago, she's like, "Oh, mom," and I'm like, "No, I'm not your mom." And
she's only about 5-6 years younger than you.
Five years. And she, you know, when they told us, we didn't really quite get it. Until they were like, "No, you got to start packing, you're leaving."
Now, there's clearly a lot more to Irina's story that begins with her emigration to the United States. But you know what? We're going to let her tell you all about it, because it looks like she's going to write a book.
I will write a book about the many stories that the Romanian people have. It will be collaborative with many Romanian people that it's going to be like a raw interview stories. And it will be a book that hopefully will be published in a few years, nothing right now. But it's something that my husband really, really encouraged me to do. And with your help as well, with being part of the First Amendment class and even this interview, I just realized that this is a story that needs to be told.
That sounds like a worthy effort. I think those of us who were fortunate enough to be born in this country and to gain citizenship and residency, all the things that your family had to struggle for, we get those things automatically. And I sometimes worry that we don't appreciate them enough.
It's a very big blessing to be able to be in this country and to be able to do, as a woman especially, to be able to do what you want to do. You want to become a lawyer, you want to become a doctor, you want to become anything. You can do it if you want to do it. And that is something that, unfortunately, my friends in Romania still do not have.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Irina Dan, my law student, and now the wife of Sean McGarry. So she's now Irina Dan McGarry. Thanks very much for sharing your story. Some parts of it were hair-raising, weren't they? At other parts, quite inspirational. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.